My pleasure to introduce Subir Sachdev, who will tell us about quantum matter and high-temperature superconductivity.
Okay, good morning. So thank you, Emmanuel, for that very interesting talk. I'll be talking in a very similar vein about quantum matter, but my playground will be electrons in crystals, much smaller crystals of electrons found in real materials rather than atoms in optical lattices. As you'll see, there are many similar ideas being explored here, especially in the context of the high-temperature superconductors, materials discovered, over 20 years ago now, but still displaying a lot of surprising new experimental facts, which have continued to fascinate us theorists. Okay, so let me just begin by talking about quantum matter a little more broadly to set the stage on the specific experiments I'll discuss as I go along. So I'll talk about very roughly, I mean, the theorists shouldn't really bother me about very precise details, but to get a qualitative picture, I'm going to talk about three different flavors of quantum matter. So the first flavor is the plain vanilla flavor, which is extremely familiar, known to all of us, and found in numerous materials. So if I take a simple metal like copper or gold, it has electrons that move freely through the entire lattice. And for the most part, you can treat these electrons as entirely independent of each other. They're quantum particles, but you can treat them one at a time, and the wave function of the many-electron system is just a product of the single electron states. So that's the simplest vanilla example of a phase of quantum matter, and it's been an approach that's been extremely successful in describing numerous materials that are technologically important. Okay. The second example, which has been studied a great deal, especially here at Perimeter, is topological quantum matter. And here, of course, the first fact is that you can't write the many-particle wave function as a product of single-particle states. It's, as we say, an entangled wave function of all the electrons, and this entanglement can even be long-range. So much so that if you take your quantum state and put it on a space with a non-trivial topology, such as a torus, that the wave function knows about the global nature of space. So, and that knowledge comes entirely from the quantum entanglement. So I'll draw a picture of chocolate ice cream here, because this is very tasty and well understood and very precise, and many people just love it. Okay. And my third flavor of quantum matter is, as you can see, a big mess. We don't quite know what's in it. It's kind of mushy, but it's also extremely fascinating, and other people like to work on it. And that's quantum matter without quasi-particles. So this is a state of matter that has lots of low-energy excitations, but these excitations don't move in straight lines like little particles. They decay very quickly. And the theoretical description is also extremely challenging. And as I will see, I'll talk about some recent results in which we can show that these toy models of quantum matter without quasi-particles are in fact duals of black holes. So hiding inside that mush is a black hole, and that's what I'm going to end my talk with. Anyway, so now I'm going to explain each of these flavors using the example of the high-temperature superconductors. Okay, so this is our playground here, a crystal of yttrium barium copper oxide. So of course this is a rather complicated looking material, but it turns out fortunately that all of the interesting electronic action happens in a single layer. So there's a square lattice of copper and oxygen, and there's many layers of these square lattices, but we just look at a single one of them, and here's a single layer of copper and oxygen. There's still many electrons in this layer, but fortunately, we can simplify even further. And in this talk, I'll just think of this system as made up of a single electron moving on the copper side. So the copper sides are the vertices of the lattices, and there's one electron roughly per orbital of this copper lattice. So amazing things happen as you now vary the density of these electrons and the temperature and see what going on in experiments. And it's taken over 20 years to fully understand, not fully, I said even today there's more things to be done. Over 20 years we learned a great deal from experiments and hopefully some from theory too. Okay, so here's the picture of what happens to the system at a particular density when there's exactly one electron per site. So that's what we call an undoped antiferromagnet. And what we know from experiments and theory and that what the electrons do is form this checkerboard arrangement where half the electrons point down and the other half point up in this very correlated manner. So in a sense, the electrons do know about each other because they're forming this pattern, but this is a very classical type of correlation. And the many particle wave function is still just a product, roughly speaking, of the single wave functions, half of them up and the other half down. So this is definitely in the vanilla category of a phase of quantum matter. I should also mention that there's another, so this material actually is an insulator. If this electron wants to move, it has to hop on that site and it gets repelled by the other electron and gets pushed back. So if you applied an electric field to this material, no current would flow. But it's the electron interactions that prevent motion of the electrons. But there's another way to get an insulator, a more familiar way, the way Bloch understood insulators when he founded solid-state physics, where you put two electrons per site. So now every state in this band of copper atoms is occupied. You can't possibly add another electron, and you can't possibly move any electron because of the exclusion principle, even when the electrons don't interact with each other. So that's the filled band, another vanilla phase of matter, which is an insulator for a very different reason. So if I now take this antiferromagnet and remove a few electrons, which is what you do in the experiments, then I get a few holes on this lattice. And the density of these holes is going to play an important number I want you to keep track of as I go through my talk. So relative to this antiferromagnet, the number of holes I have here, I call that P. So there's P holes per square of the copper oxygen lattice. But keep in mind that if I measure this relative not to the antiferromagnet, but to the band insulator, there's 1 plus P holes. So the electrons were non-interacting, which is the approach a semiconductor physicist would take traditionally for something like this. The semiconductor physicist would conclude that this has 1 plus P holes because the counting is done relative to the fully filled or the fully empty band. Okay. All right, so now what happens as a function of P, that's the lower axis here, and temperature. So there is a somewhat still evolving phase diagram, and I've just put a number of acronyms on the various phases that appear. I'm only going to actually describe the higher temperature regime in some detail. And there's of course been a lot of fun over the last 20 plus years through amazing sets of experiments in kind of reaching the conclusion that this is the important common set of phases that are present in a wide variety of materials. And I won't be giving credit to many of the experimentalists who've, for lack of time, who've contributed to this. So, but just to begin, there's the antiferromagnet that I already showed you with the checkerboard arrangement of spins. And of course, the reason we're interested in these class of materials is because of the high temperature superconductivity. You have superconductivity up to 100 Kelvin or so. And this is definitely, in many ways, the most interesting phase in this phase diagram, but I won't say anything more about it because as far as we can tell, it's still a vanilla phase in the sense that you can think of the superconductivity as due to the pairing of electrons and the pairs of electrons then both condense. Of course, what causes them to pair and why do they both condense are interesting questions, but as questions of principle of what the superconducting state is, it's still a product of pairs of electrons, roughly speaking. So I won't say much more about it. So I'm going to focus on the phases above the critical temperature for this talk. And let me begin on the right here with the FL, or Fermi liquid. So this is a picture from a photo emission experiment. And what it's showing you is the boundary between the empty and the occupied states in momentum space. So the axes here are momentum, and the states inside the circle are actually empty of electrons, and the ones outside are full of electrons. Or if I talk in terms of holes, there's holes inside this surface. So now if the counting of electrons, if I just count them independently, has to work out right, the number of holes in here should be 1 plus P, And that does indeed work out in the experiment very accurately. You find that the area enclosed by this boundary, which is called the Fermi surface, is 1 plus p. So let me just here characterize some basic properties of this well-understood metallic state then. So in this regime, it seems that this material looks not so different from copper or gold or some other simple metal. So the Fermi surface, as I said, separates empty and occupied states in momentum space. The density of electrons now can be varies continuously. I can change p, and as I change p, the position of the Fermi surface will change, and I'll have more holes or electrons inside the Fermi surface. But most importantly, the low-lying excitations of this system, when you include the electron interactions, are quasi-particles, meaning that you can excite electrons across this boundary of the Fermi surface, and as long as they're close to the surface, they live a very long time. And these long-lived quasi-particles can be used as a description of the dynamics. And I guess I skipped ahead. And also, finally, as I've also mentioned already, the area enclosed by the Fermi surface is linked precisely to the density of electrons. Okay, so that's a kind of review of basic facts of the vanilla aspects of solid-state physics and this particular phase. All right, so that's well understood now, and now let's explore the rest of the phase diagram. So in the remaining part of my talk, I'm going to talk about two phases in particular, the pseudo-gap, which I'll tell you what I think is going on there, and the strange metal. So let me just jump ahead then. So this is the outline of the remaining part of my talk. I'll begin with the pseudo-gap metal and then turn to the strange metal where we understand much less, but there are toy models that have interesting connections to other fields of physics. Okay, so that's the pseudo-gap metal that I want to discuss now. So one of its characteristics is this photoemission experiment showing what are called Fermi arcs. So remember, when I was in the Fermi liquid, I had a perfect Fermi surface separating the empty and the occupied states. And now if you do the same experiment in this regime, you get this rather bizarre features of these arcs, and they don't really seem to fit in any sensible theory of the electrons as they are. So what I'm going to propose that actually, and others have also proposed, that these arcs are really just one side of a Fermi surface, and there is a Fermi surface on the other side too. It's just very weak. It's suppressed by electron interaction in a certain way, but there is, and more precision experiment eventually, hopefully, see the other side too under the right conditions. So, okay, so that's the theory of what this metallic phase looks like, this Fermi surface, these pockets of electron or holes in these small regions. Well, okay, that can be experimentally tested by various methods that I'll mention in a minute. But more importantly, then, the area enclosed by these pockets, however, does not obey the rules of Fermi liquid theory. In Fermi liquid theory, we know that any Fermi surface must have a total volume of 1 plus p. And that's certainly not true here in this picture. So how is that possible? So what I want to show you is a very simple intuitive argument that that's possible, essentially if and only if this kind of metal coexists with topological order. So the pseudo-gap is going to be then, as you can see, a swirl of both vanilla and chocolate. It is a coexistence of both vanilla features of Fermi liquid theory along with the chocolate features of topological order. So what is the evidence that there is indeed a Fermi pocket of size p in the pseudo-gap? Well, there's quite a bit of evidence in the transport measurements. And I could go into some detail of the experimental description, but I'll ask your permission to just mention it. And if you want to know further, I'd be happy to discuss after this talk. These are important experiments, especially these two here by Dirk van der Merrill in Geneva and Martin Grimmen in Minnesota, who have carefully examined precisely the pseudo-gap regime and found that if you just took the vanilla theory of a Fermi liquid, for, say, the optical conductivity or the magnetoresistance or this older experiment on the Hall effect, then the field dependence, the frequency dependence, and the temperature dependence all completely match the Fermi liquid theory with one glaring difference. And the glaring difference is the number of electrons, which has to be 1 plus p, or one number of holes, is p. So there's a numerical difference, but the qualitative features are identical. One particular set of experiments that I've been involved in also give you indirect evidence for this mixture of chocolate and vanilla in the pseudogap regime, and these are the scanning tunneling microscopy experiments. So this has to do with this DW region, which I have shown in this phase diagram at lower temperatures. You start from the pseudogap, you go to lower temperatures, and what you see in these beautiful scanning tunneling pictures of the surface of a single copper oxygen layer is this picture here. So the plus signs are now the copper sites. And roughly speaking, you can think of the colors here as the density of electrons. So what you can see here is that the density of electrons is rather inhomogeneous. It seems to be a rather strange-looking pattern. You find this pattern everywhere in the crystal. And you know, this particular oxygen, this copper is quite different from that one, and the oxygen sites are certainly all very different from each other too. So this kind of pattern shows up in many different experiments, and over the past couple of years, there's been quite strong evidence that this pattern is a signature of what we call a D form factor density wave, which is a very peculiar kind of density wave with internal angular momentum, and which perfectly matches a variety of experiments. For our purposes today, the utility of this knowledge about the low temperature behavior is that you can ask, you know, what is the kind of state up here which at lower temperature will turn into this rather peculiar looking pattern? And this pocket Fermi surfaces very naturally do this. Okay. So much for the experimental evidence. Now let me try to give you some simple intuitive picture of what this strange looking metal really is. What is its wave function? So as I began my talk, the way we explore this phase diagram is you start with an antiferromagnet, and then you put in a few holes. These holes are now going to move around, the spins are going to fluctuate, and how do you get a metallic state with these rather strange properties seen in the experiments? So here's our proposal for a rather simple-looking wave function, which has a mixture of both Fermi liquid theory and topological order. So here's a snapshot of the wave function. So some of the electrons, say the electrons on this pair of sites, form a spin singlet. So this is an EPR pair of two electrons, one up and the other down. Neither one is up or down, but they're perfectly correlated. So these two electrons are entangled with each other, and that's what this ellipse represents. So it's a valence bond, or a covalent bond, or so on. And that's happening here, and here, and here, and so on. Now, we had a few holes. Where did those holes go? Well, the holes are sitting. So these dimers, the blue dimers, then represent these covalent bonds. The holes are sitting on these green dimers. What is this green dimer? Well, let me open it up. What the green dimer is really a superposition of an electron sitting there and an electron sitting there. And for some reason, that electron doesn't want to move away effectively sits in the bonding orbital. And so I represent that electron in the bonding orbital by this green dimer. And this green dimer is a fermion because it's got an odd number of electrons, but it has the same quantum numbers of the electrons. It's got charge E and a spin a half. Okay, so this is an electron-like object which can now try to move through the lattice, but at the same time, you have these blue dimers representing the other electrons in EPR pairs. Okay, so but what is the full wave function? This is just a snapshot. If Emmanuel took his magical microscope and looked at it, maybe he'll see this. And looked at every electron. But the actual wave function is a superposition of many terms, just like the term that Emmanuel showed us. So what do the terms look like? So they involve resonance between these dimers. So you could have, where did that go? Okay. For example, that pair of dimers can resonate, and now you can see the green dimer has moved from there to there, and so on. And this keeps happening. That dimer can move around the entire lattice. And then the blue dimers can also resonate with each other. So the net result is that the green dimers can move through the lattice, relatively independent of each other. And so they're sort of like independent electrons. But to move through the lattice, they have to move the blue dimers out of the way. There's some topological structure they have to keep track of. It's a very correlated hop. They just can't move by themselves. they have to resonate with something else. And it's that resonance and that correlation between all the dimers that entangles all of them and gives you this topological order. So let me actually make that a little more precise. Suppose I take this wave function I just sketched for you and in a thought experiment put it on this torus. So you got a state sitting on the torus. If the torus is big enough, it won't get deformed too much. But now that you give me the state, I'm going to write down another wave function, which differs from the first state in just a very simple way. It differs by, roughly speaking, a branch cut around one of the loops of the torus. So what does this branch cut do? Well, here's the original wave function, and I draw a branch cut across it. And when I draw the branch cut, I pick up a sine of minus one for every dimer that I cut. So I just draw this branch cut across. I pick up a sine of minus one for every term. So I had many, many, many terms in the wave function, and you know, some will pick up a total factor of minus one, and some won't, and so on. But now you see that as these dimers resonate, for example, this pair of dimers resonates over here, the minus ones are gone. But now you notice that these minus ones always come and go in pairs, at least with these local moves. And therefore, actually, if I look at the local wave function, nothing really has changed. The overall factor is exactly the same. Relative factors are the same. So in fact, don't seem to have got a new wave function. It seems like the same state. But globally, when I look at the global aspects of the wave function, I find that it's actually a state that's orthogonal with essentially the same energy. So you've got this additional degeneracy, in this case a four-fold degeneracy for this, well, a slightly generalized version of this model. And that's the aspect of topological order. So the fundamental point here is that you can only get free electron-like objects of density p, the wrong density, if at the same time you also have some version of topological order. And that's our picture of what could possibly be going on in the pseudo-gap metal, and I've indicated some of the experiments that support this picture. Okay, so that's the end of part one of my talk, which was a description then of the pseudo-gap metal, and I'm now going to turn to somewhat more speculative ideas on what the strange metal phase is. So this is something that's also been studied a great deal since the very beginning of the discovery of high-TC, the strange metal here, the SM. And I won't go through all the vast variety of experiments. Let me just summarize here some of the more important basic characteristics. So first of all, like the pseudo-gap metal and the Fermi liquid, it's what we call a compressible phase of quantum matter, that you can continuously vary the density by varying some chemical potential. And that's certainly true over here. Now, although the strange metal is present here at above a certain temperature, I'm really going to think of it as something that, in principle, could be present even down at low temperatures. Furthermore, we know that from many experiments, that there are excitations at arbitrary low energy, so it's what we call a gapless phase. It's not a gapped system like the quantum Hall effect. And finally, and most importantly, unlike in the Fermi liquid, all spectra are very broad, so it has no quasi-particles. You can't think of the excitations of this metal as some long-lived renormalized particles that are interacting with each other. So that's the situation, and of course, there are many experimental characteristics, most of which really today are not understood. And many theoretical models have been proposed of varying degrees of success, including some by us. I'm not going to go into any of those details. They're rather quite technical. What I want to tell you about in the remaining time is a toy model that we proposed a few years ago, which we've gotten, and others have gotten interested in again, which is a toy model of a strange metal, which was motivated initially by the physics of the cuprates, but let's see where that takes us. So one way to present the model, this isn't the quite way we propose it. Recently, we were inspired by Alexei Kitaev, who had proposed a version closer to this. So here's the model. You have N sites, these are these circles, which I've numbered, in this case, from 1 to 14. Then, and their electrons are fermions, and for simplicity, I'm going to make the fermions spinless, moving on all the sites. But the way they can move is rather peculiar. They can only move by hopping in pairs. So, for example, if I take this quartet of sites, 3, 5, 7, and 13, then a pair of electrons on site 5 and 13 can, say, hop to sites 3 and 7 together with some amplitude, which I call J3, 5, 7, 13, and so on. So you just pick any pair of sites, any quartet of sites, and then there's various pairs of electrons that can exchange between them. And that's the model, and we're going to take these J's to be just random numbers. Now, why random? You know, I think Neil didn't like randomness. Well, partly here, randomness is a technical choice. It makes things a little simpler. It's possible there are non-random models that have the same behavior, but we don't know at that. But it's in the end, it turns out that if I look at, say, site 5, and n is large enough, the properties of site 5 will be indistinguishable from any other site. So there is kind of a self-averaging if the system is large enough. All right, so that's our Hamiltonian. Electrons can move only in pairs, period, with random amplitudes, and between any pairs of sites. Simple enough model, but this model turns out to realize a strange model, and it's really the simplest model, as far as I know, that can give you a compressible phase which doesn't have quasiparticles. And this one satisfies those criteria. Those are very difficult criteria to satisfy. Okay. So what are some of its properties? So here I want you to keep track of this number Q, which is the density of electrons per site. I should also say, for the mathematician in the audience, you know, this whole model is defined by these two equations. You have this algebra of fermion operators and this. So if I could just give these two equations to a mathematician, she should come back with a complete solution. I mean, don't need to know any physics beyond that in principle. Okay, which is really quite remarkable how much complexity will appear from just these two equations. Okay, so one of the things we showed way back in 93 was that the density of states for adding or removing an electron has this behavior. So you have this quantum state sitting there on this cluster, and you try to add an electron with energy omega or remove an electron with energy omega. And both of them diverge as 1 over square root of omega, except the amplitude for removing an electron differs from that from adding an electron. And that ratio I'm going to call e to the minus 2 pi, the script e. And remember that number e for a while. Okay. So this already tells you it's a non-Fermi liquid, because in a Fermi liquid, this would be a constant. The local density of states in an ordinary metal is just a constant. All right. So that's a very interesting property, then. It's a compressible strange metal. Okay, then there's something I call the equation of state, which is how this number E is related to the number Q. So that turns out to be a rather subtle property of this model, and we showed it this very peculiar looking function. It doesn't matter what the details are, but it's something you can do by solving this particular model in the larger limit. And finally, already in 2001, and actually building on this earlier work by Parkola et al., we found that this model had another peculiar feature. It had a finite ground state entropy, meaning that as you lower the temperature and take the derivative of the free energy to get the entropy, you get a number that didn't go to zero as temperature went to zero. Now, the third law of thermodynamics demands that this go to zero. So when we saw this, we were saying, okay, this is a problem, and we were kind of embarrassed by it all, and we kind of kept secret about it, didn't talk too much, mentioned that too much in the discussion. But we did, fortunately, actually compute this entropy in an appendix and came up with this rather peculiar-looking result, that the derivative of the entropy, or the ground state entropy, with respect to the charge, is 2 pi e. So on the left-hand side, we have quantities that depend on the entire system. It's the total entropy, the total charge. It's not a low energy property at all. It's a thermodynamic derivative. And on the right-hand side, we have a number, E, that depends on this very low energy property. It's what we call an infrared property. So this is a very peculiar connection, somewhat similar to the Luttinger theorem also, which connects a macroscopic quantity, a macroscopic thermodynamic derivative here, to a low-energy property, which is just this asymmetry in the density of states. So this model has a certain extensive degeneracy at low enough temperatures, and this seemed really unusual. We had never met a model that generically had such a property, and we pretty much decided this wasn't that interesting and stopped working on it until recently. Today, of course, as you perhaps recall from John Preskill's talk, there's a lot of interest in states that are protected somehow from the environment that have degeneracy and are not sensitive to perturbations, and this seems to be in that class, although we don't know. That's something that Alexei Kateyev has been speculated on recently. Anyway, so now I'm going to fill in the right-hand side of this picture, talk about something completely different. So this is in the spirit of the holographic correspondence that John Preskill discussed yesterday between strongly interacting quantum theories, in particular conformal field theories, and theories of gravity. So here we don't have a conformal field theory. It's this particular lattice fermion model, although it does have certain emergent symmetries, conformal-like symmetries at low energies. And what I'm going to show you is pretty strong evidence that this theory is dual to a theory of gravity. And in fact, one of the theories, it's dual to at least in the low energy limit, is just the theory of our universe. You take the theory of Maxwell and Einstein for electromagnetism and gravity, and all you do is you add a cosmological constant that's large and negative. So now if you solve these equations, you get the one of the solutions is the solution of a charged black hole in asymptotically anti-de-Sitter space. So you have a boundary of this space, and there's some charge density, which I'll call Q, sitting on the boundary. And the area of the boundary could be finite or infinite. I call it AB. Then there's a, there's a horizon of a black hole. And in the near horizon region, the metric is anti-de-Sitter space times the real space RD, which is X. So what do I mean by anti-de-Sitter space? Anti-de-Sitter space here is this particular metric between the distance zeta, zeta equals infinity, the position of the horizon, and the time t. In addition, because you have this charge density on the boundary, there's also an electric flux that's given by Gauss's law, and that electric field is what I call E. Okay. So this is the solution of the Einstein-Maxwell equation. There's some boundary here with a charge density and a gravitational field which looks something like this and a horizon of a black hole. Okay. Now, what I'm going to argue now that if you think of this as the holographic representation of some quantum theory, then that quantum theory is basically this model, these clusters of electrons roughly sprinkled here at some density of the points x. I'm going to look at the very low energy region where all the spatial points essentially decouple from each other. Okay, so what's the evidence for that? Well, one thing you can do is you can take this background and let a fermion propagate on it. So that's, you take a Dirac fermion moving this background, and you compute the local density of states that implies by the usual ADS-CFT correspondence on the boundary. And what you get is this result right here. At exactly this form, this 1/2 you get only for a specific value of m, but fine, you tune the value of m. But what's crucial here is that this number E, which characterizes spectral asymmetry, is the same as this electric field E. So that's why I called it E. In this gravitational representation, it's the electric field. Okay. So this particular strange metal was first discussed by Faulkner et al. So it's an explicit solution like this one of something that is a big mess, has no quasi-particles, and is compressible. And this looked like a nice correspondence. So what I realized recently, then there's also the question of the relationship between E, the electric flux here, and the charge density. Now, that's a rather complicated relationship. It's not the one that you find on this model. It depends on what particular precise configuration you're using, and it's something you can determine, and so let me just skip over it. However, the remarkable new result appears when you ask how things change on this side as you change the charge density. So if I increase the charge density on the boundary a little bit, what will happen is that the horizon will move a bit closer, and the area of the horizon will increase. So you then ask, how does the area of the horizon increase with respect to the charge density? So this actually follows from properties of black hole thermodynamics, by Hawking, Bardeen, and Carter, I guess, and subsequent developments by many other people. And it turns out to be, in this particular case, a relationship between this derivative, the derivative of the horizon area to the charge density, to the electric field. So this is an identity you can prove, ultimately just from Einstein's equations. dAh dq is 8 pi e times the Newton's constant e. Okay, so now you see this remarkable relation between these two. Here you have, that's the punchline. Here you have a macroscopic quantity having to do with the total area of the horizon, the total charge density, and it's related to this electric field E, which really determines the low-energy Green's functions and the electric field right near the horizon. And here you had, again, a macroscopic quantity related to the same electric field E. And clearly, E and E here are the same thing because they precisely characterize actually low-energy behavior of all observables. So it seems natural if this theory is somehow dual to that, that you should really equate these two. And if you equate them, you get precisely the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is the area divided by 4g. So that's, in some sense, with assumptions that this fermion model is dual to this gravitational theory, then a derivation, if you wish, of the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in a model with UV finite. So this thing has no UV divergences, it has no supersymmetry. But to compute this and these relations, it is really crucial that the model be UV finite. You need certain properties of the high energy behavior to show this relationship. You can't just show it by looking at the low energy theory. And that kind of UV completion has previously been provided in all previous calculations, as far as I know, for the Hawking entropy using string theory, which is certainly a lot more complicated than this. Okay. So that's the conclusion of my talk now. I think you can see what are my favorite flavors of ice cream. There's a mixture of vanilla and chocolate, or a mixture of Fermi liquids and topological order found in the pseudogap, and this strange metal, which seems to have close connections, at least in this infinite range model, to the physics of black holes. So I think, especially, so Kateyev, as I mentioned, has been working on this aspect recently, and his motivation is especially to address some of the deep questions on black hole physics that John Preskill was addressing yesterday. And so let's see, there's much more to be done with this much simpler model, which is a complete model now of horizons of black holes, and also seems to have connection to the physics of the cuprates. Okay, so thank you very much.
Just would like to check the dimensions of this matchup. I mean, is it a five-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space you're talking about?
It doesn't matter. It works for any D.
Works for any D. Thank you.
Yeah, this is for. I'm only looking at the low-energy local correlations. Now, if you go out here and look at the spatial correlations, that I don't have information of from this model. This model is really in this side. It's really a zero plus one-dimensional model. It has only time. It's like it's a matrix. You can think of it as a matrix model, a fermionic matrix model. On Fock space. So roughly speaking, it's like a matrix model on an exponential e to the n times e to the n space. So it's a little more complicated than the usual matrix model. And that's what allows you to get these degeneracies and then relationship to black holes.
Yeah. Hi. So I know that condensed matter physicists are kind of reluctant to jump into holography. So do you think that results like that convince them or can convince them to like gain intuition and insight from holography?
Well, I worked on this model, as I said, 20 years ago or something like that, and I gave up because nobody was interested in it and because it had some strange features. But those are all turning out to be wonderful new features, and I'm very excited. And certainly, as I mentioned, this is a lot easier to learn than string theory. So let's see. I mean, I think there's a lot more progress to be done in using these much simpler models of quantum black holes. And you could certainly use a lot of help. So Yes.
Hello?
Yeah.
Thank you for the talk. I was just wondering whether you had any intuition or guess what would happen if you tried to then do a phase transition on the boundary to, say, the other phases you've been discussing, and what would happen in the bulk?
We have thought about phase transition to the Fermi liquid, so which is the vanilla phase. And that typically corresponds to just cutting off the holographic space. Just put a hard wall here, and then the fermion gets trapped near the boundary, and that looks like a Fermi liquid. Getting the pseudo gap with mixture of general topological order, at least of the gap type. So like things like fractional quantum Hall states, or spin liquids or toric cores that have a gap. Holography generally is not very useful there. Holography is a subject for gaps, for gapless systems with lots of low energy excitations. Then this emergent space can be almost classical. When you're talking about gap system, the gravitational fluctuations are so strong and so quantum that it's not a very useful way to think about things in general. Yes.
Constructing a solution of Einstein's Maxwell equation rather than a gravitational field theory. Am I correct in saying that this is very different?
It's a cousin, I would say. I mean, certainly using some of the insights from the conventional ADS-CFT correspondence. But so, for example, that applies to conformal field theories. Now, conformal field theories are not compressible phases. They are at a fixed density. And they're particle hole symmetric. So anytime you break, you vary the density, you're going to break that particle hole asymmetry. And in fact, that's really crucial to the whole mapping. So it's very different, certainly. But it's, in principle, possible to take a string theory and put it under various charges and get a phase at finite density. But that's much harder to study. And we certainly don't have any essentially exact results for holography for compressible phases the way you Maldacena has for the super Yang Mills theory, which is not compressible. That's a conformal field theory. So this is, I would say, the first example of it's not an exact result. It's really a conjecture supported by a lot of evidence at this point between a non-conformal lattice model, which is compressible, and a theory of gravity.